Thank you, Brother Randall, and good afternoon, brethren. Again, we're very happy to be with you here this afternoon. Before we begin our discourse, we'd like to bring you the love and greetings of our daughter and son-in-law and grandson, Marsha, David, and Jonathan Hawk. They wanted very much to be here, and they planned to be here, but Brother David is ill. He hasn't been feeling well for a few weeks now, and evidently hasn't been getting very much better, and they thought it necessary to stay home today. The English word discipline is found just once in the King James Bible, and that's in Job 36:10. We're not even going to read Job 36:10 this afternoon. We are going to consider the thought of discipline, which occurs many, many times in the King James Bible, using other words. We'd like to begin by reading from Hebrews 12, verses 5 through 11. We're not going to read from the King James. We're going to read from the Revised Standard Version. You might want to follow along with the King James and compare it as we go along. It's not too much difference, except the English word discipline is not used. Instead, another word is used, and you'll see that immediately when we read it. The Revised Standard Version reads, "And have you forgotten the exhortation which addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor lose courage when you are punished by him. For the Lord disciplines him whom he loves, and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then are you illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time at their pleasure, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. Later, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." I'm sure you've noticed that the word discipline is used instead of the word chastening, which we find in the King James translation of the Bible. The two words are somewhat similar in meaning, but not exactly the same. Discipline seems to mean training. It includes the thought of correction. It might at times include the thought of punishment, but it's not limited to this. It's a more broad term to mean training. Chastening seems a more limited term to refer primarily to punishment, and even a particular form of punishment such as beating. Our text cites the example, which is what the Apostle Paul uses to illustrate the point, that of our earthly parents, how they disciplined us, how they trained us as children. This is one aspect of the subject of discipline, and we'd like to deal with it briefly this afternoon, although this won't be the main point of our lesson. We have had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. I think just about all of us can remember when we were children. We had parents, and they tried their best to train us in the way that they saw it best. They sometimes refused to permit us to do some things we would have liked to do, and And sometimes they made us do things we didn't want to do. And when we were children, we probably didn't like it. We probably wished we could do as we pleased. And we couldn't wait for the time when we would grow up and we could make our own decisions and do what we wanted to do. Some of you now are no doubt in the process of raising children, disciplining children, training them. Children need this discipline. They need guidance. Why? Because they can't think like adults. They haven't had the experience to think and act as adults should be able to think and act. So they need training. They need guidance. As a small example, I can recall as a child, sometimes I was busily engaged in doing something I really wanted to do, and it was mealtime. And I was called to come and eat my meal, but first you have to wash your hands. Well, I didn't think my hands were that dirty. And besides, they're just going to get dirty again anyway when I'm through, so why should I wash my hands? Well, this is the way a child reasons. But this is foolish reasoning, as we know. But children have to be disciplined. They can't think like and reason like adults. They haven't had the experience. When very young, they have to be trained along the lines of personal cleanliness for their own health, for their own well-being, for their own good. Children also need to be trained to respect the rights and property of others for their own good. Children need to be taught the principles of honesty and decency, again, for their own good. And this is true not only of Bible students' children, this is true of any children. Any parents in the world need to teach their children these things, honesty, decency, respecting the rights and property of others. These are just moral principles that all parents have the duty and obligation to teach their children. Christian parents have an even further responsibility. They must also teach their children these things, but they must teach their children to love and respect God and the principles of truth and righteousness. Christian parents have an extremely difficult job in this present evil world, surrounded by all its evil influences. Children are not all alike, and we're not going to stand before you this afternoon and set down a list of do's and don'ts, and this is the way you must train your children. We don't think that can be done. Some children are of a more rebellious nature. Others are more passive and inclined to obedience. There's no set of rules that's going to apply in every situation and bring the desired results. Some need more training and more severe discipline than others. Sometimes there are some who just need a word of correction or a look from their parents, and is sufficient to correct them and show them what they should do. Others need to be corrected in other ways, and sometimes real punishment is called for. In any case, the purpose of the discipline must be borne in mind. The purpose of the discipline is the proper training of the child for his own good. The purpose of the discipline must never be to take vengeance or retaliation, never to be to satisfy our own pride and show our authority that we have the situation in control. The discipline of our children must never be for the purpose of impressing someone else, but for the child's own good. That's the only purpose. Because we love the child and we're concerned for its welfare. We hear a great deal today in the world about child abuse. And this is really a big problem in the world and a very serious thing. We're not minimizing it. We don't know it to be a major problem among the brethren, In fact, we don't know of any case of child abuse among the brethren that we're aware of. But there's another serious problem today, too, and that is lack of training of children, lack of discipline. This also is very detrimental to the child. A child lacking in discipline, lacking in training, is more likely to be selfish, thinking, I can do as I please. I don't need to be concerned with how what I'm doing is affecting someone else. Disrespectful of the rights of others. That child is more likely to get into serious trouble, not only as a child, but when he becomes an adult as well. Now you might say, I know of children who were very mischievous and rebellious as children. They got into all kinds of scrapes and trouble as children, and when they grew up, they were just fine. And that may be very true. There are children like that. But we can't count on that. We can't count on it that because our child is very disobedient and very mischievous, well, he's just going through a phase and he'll straighten out. I don't have to be concerned about it or do anything about it. When he gets a little older, he'll straighten himself out. We can't count on that. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. We're not going to dwell on this point. We call attention to it here because the Apostle Paul calls attention to it. And because it's one aspect of the subject of discipline. The Apostle Paul uses this training of children to illustrate how God trains his spiritual children. He says, God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom the father does not discipline? He tells us, just like we're trying to train our children, God is disciplining and training us. Why does God discipline us? For the same reasons that we discipline our children, for their own good. God disciplines us for our own good, not to show his authority, Not to satisfy his ego or his pride, but for our good he disciplines us. We like to list three reasons why we think God is particularly disciplining us as his children. The first one is for our training for the future. Just like we're trying to train our children for the future, for the time when they will grow up and have greater responsibilities than they do now. So God is training us, his spiritual children, for some work he has in mind for our future, if we make our calling and election sure. How does he do this? Well, let's observe how he trained and disciplined his only begotten son, Jesus. Concerning Jesus, we read in Hebrews 5:8, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. This is an amazing statement when we stop and think about it. Here was Jesus, God's only begotten son, who as the Logos had never been anything but obedient to his heavenly Father, and needing to learn obedience by the things which he suffered. Can we imagine such a thing? Would we think of any of our children who are always obedient, if we know of any children who are always obedient, and think that, well, they're going to have to learn obedience by the things they suffer? Well, God saw fit to do that with his son, Jesus. Jesus was always obedient, but circumstances were always favorable to obedience. God was going to teach him to be obedient even when things were not favorable, when it would have been easier to disobey. This is a strong kind of discipline. Part of our training is likewise to teach us obedience through suffering. Hebrews 4:15 we read concerning Jesus. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Jesus had to come to earth, become a man, and experience the same kind of infirmities that fallen man has, although he was not a fallen man. He had to become familiar with what it's like to suffer physical pain. He had to learn what it's like to suffer ridicule, persecution, be evil spoken of, be considered a criminal, in fact. Mankind experiences these kind of things, and Jesus had to experience what this was like too. And that way, he could be touched with a feeling of our infirmities. He could then sympathize with fallen man in dealing with them in the future, in the times of restitution and restoring them. Because he himself experienced what this is like, and he could know better how to deal with them. He deals with us the same way. 1 Corinthians 10:13. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. We too have the same kind of afflictions that the rest of the world have. We get sick, we suffer pain, we suffer mental anguish, we suffer persecution, we suffer all kinds of things, the same kind of things that the world has to suffer. No temptation but such as is common to man. And why? Because then, having had these same experiences, when we are sharing with Jesus in the work of restitution, we too will be able to sympathize with them because we have experienced the same things ourselves. And we know what difficulties they have in overcoming sinful tendencies. And so some of God's discipline is for the purpose of training us for work of the future in the form of developing our characters so that we might be better and able to deal with mankind. One of the elements of character which we need to develop is patience. And how do we develop patience? Do we learn patience by everything going smoothly just the way we would like it to go? If everything went smoothly all the time, would we be very patient? We might think we would. Well, it's easy to be patient when things are going the way you would like them to go. But we suspect that if everything went that way, we'd become very impatient. Because tribulation worketh patience. And it's only when things don't go the way we want to go that we can learn patience. Tribulation worketh patience. Only through difficulties can we learn to be patient. Reason number two why God disciplines us, he tests us. 1 Peter 5:7. That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Tried with fire, tested. This seems to imply difficult experiences. Something is tried with fire. Well, that's a fiery trial. That's a difficult trial. How will we react to it? How will hardness, difficulty, trial affect us? Will we learn the lesson from it? Or will we become bitter? Will we still have faith in the Lord and trust the Lord even though he permits some difficult experience to come upon us? Or will we become bitter toward him, bitter toward everyone as a result of the trial, and lose faith and confidence in the Lord? Will we still want to serve him or not? It reminds me of a person I recall some years ago. I don't think any of you here knew this person or knows this person. Became interested in the truth, a attended meetings for a while, went so far as being immersed in water, claimed to be consecrated to the Lord, and seemed to be coming along in the truth. And then this person became sick and was in the hospital for a while, had a very painful experience. As a result of that experience in the hospital, which was very painful, that person became bitter. That person became resentful, thinking, I shouldn't have to endure something like this. That person today is back in the nominal church and has no interest in the truth. That was a test. I don't know if that person was spirit-begotten or not. I doubt it. Looking back over the situation, I doubt it. I'd like to think that person wasn't, for their own good. But it illustrates the point. A difficult experience can be a test. How is it going to affect us? Are we going to learn patience from it? As we said, tribulation worketh patience. Are we going to learn to be more trustful and loving to God and realize our need for Him and our dependency on Him? Or will we become bitter and resentful? Why should I have to endure something like this? It's a test. Another reason for discipline, that God sometimes disciplines us, is for punishment. Sometimes we punish our children because they've been disobedient. Such punishment should always be for correction. Although, being imperfect, we sometimes do this in anger, and sometimes not properly. We should do this. We shouldn't do it in anger. When we punish our children, it should be for their correction, so that they would learn the needed lesson and not through anger and retaliation. God didn't punish Jesus. He didn't need to punish Jesus, because Jesus never did anything wrong. He never did anything to deserve any punishment, so God didn't punish him. This isn't true of us. We do things wrong sometimes. We do things foolishly. We do things we shouldn't do, or when we neglect to do things we should do. And sometimes we need to be punished, just like our children. And when they disobey us, we need to punish them sometimes for their own good. God punishes us sometimes for our own good. Hebrews 12:10, the passage we just read, for they, our natural parents, disciplined us for a short time at their pleasure, but He disciplines us for our good, that we may share His holiness. So we might learn the lesson and not become disobedient along that same line again. And so we may rest assured that all disciplining experiences the Lord permits to come upon us, He intends for our good. And this is in harmony with Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose. It's for our own good. And now along comes a difficult experience, and we wonder, is this intended to train us for our work of the future? Is this simply a test upon us to see how we're going to react? Or is God punishing us for something? I think we've all had these thoughts when something comes along, some trial comes along that we don't like, and we wonder, why am I having this trial? What am I supposed to learn from it? Is this a punishment? Is this a test? Or is God training me for something in the future? Sometimes we might think we know, especially if we know we've done something wrong and deserving of punishment, we might immediately accept it as punishment. Well, yes, I can see this is really the result of my own foolishness and my own wrongdoing, and this is why I'm having this experience. Sometimes this might not be the case. Sometimes we might think, well, this is probably just a test. And other times we might think, well, I guess God's teaching me something for the future. But sometimes we don't really know. And sometimes we, all three might be possible, but we don't really know what God intends by this experience. And maybe we don't know until a long time afterward. Maybe sometimes we don't know at all. But we can rest assured of one thing, that God intends it for our own good. And while we can't always be sure of the exact reason for that experience, we can look to see what lesson we can draw from it. Now, we're not suggesting that the Lord directly causes all the difficult experiences that we have. We won't want to blame everything that happens to us on the Lord. Satan is very active. Satan desires to injure us. He desires to do things which would stumble us, be detrimental to us. Sometimes other individuals might deliberately try to injure us. And we can't blame that on the Lord. Well, the Lord did it. Well, no, the Lord didn't do that. Nevertheless, the Lord did permit it. Whether Satan did it or some other individual did it, the Lord permitted it. And for some wise purpose, we might be sure. These are some of the reasons the Lord disciplines us. But now there's still another aspect of discipline which we think is even more important, which is really the point of our lesson this afternoon, the aspect of self-discipline. We said before that in dealing with our natural children, they don't all require the same amount of discipline. They don't all require the same type of discipline. There are different personalities and different characters among our children. And there are, likewise, with God's spiritual children. They don't all need the same amount of discipline or the same type of discipline. They don't all need the same thing. We're in various stages of development. Some of us are naturally inclined to be more obedient to God and more submissive and more passive. And we don't need so much harsh discipline. And others might be of a more rebellious nature, and God really has to come down hard on us sometimes. The amount and severity of the discipline is going to depend in large measure on how we discipline ourselves. We think there's a principle stated here in along this line in 1 Corinthians 11, 31 and 32. There the Apostle Paul hints at self-discipline. He says, "For if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, we are chastened of the Lord, that we should not be condemned with the world." Again, we can go back to our childhood. We were faced with doing something we didn't want to do. And if even as a child, if we disciplined ourselves and went about and did it even though we'd rather not do it, even though we didn't like to do it, if we did it uncomplainingly and willingly, it was much easier than refusing to do it or not doing it and suffering the consequences. Much as we didn't like to do it, it was easier to do it sometimes, well, all the time if we would. It would be easier to do it than to not do it and suffer the consequences. And so if we examine ourselves and discipline ourselves where self-restraint, self-control is needed, we will need less discipline from the Lord. In one of the passages in Hebrews 12 that we read, the Apostle Paul pointed out that all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. This is true. All discipline is painful rather than pleasant. But self-discipline is generally less painful than discipline received at the hand of someone else. If we discipline ourselves, it still isn't pleasant, but it's less unpleasant than having to be disciplined by somebody else. In the world, we have some very noble examples of self-discipline. Perhaps one of the easiest understood is that in the world of athletics, the athlete who is training for some competition, regardless of what the event is, what the sport is, whether it be running or some game or whatever it is, the athlete is preparing himself physically for that contest. He must discipline himself, or he won't be ready for that contest. He won't be physically ready. The best athletes are those who receive who require the least amount of enforced discipline from their coach. The best athletes will discipline themselves and won't require to be told, well, you must do this, you must practice so many hours today, you must refrain from eating this kind of food, you must not do this, and you must do that. The best athletes don't need to be told those things. They'll do those things for themselves. And they'll even go beyond. They'll practice more than what is required. And they'll exercise more than what is required. They'll discipline themselves. You ever seen a child, perhaps you had the experience yourself, or you know of a child who takes piano lessons, and the child's instructor requires, well, you must practice your lesson a half hour a day. And so the child sits at the piano and practices with one eye on the clock, and as soon as the half hour is up, the child leaves the piano and runs to do something else. Is that child ever going to make a great concert pianist? Obviously not. The child doesn't have enough interest in it to discipline himself to practice. He's only practicing the minimum of what is required. But those who become great concert pianists don't worry about how long they're practicing. They forget about time. They're so absorbed in their music and in their practicing, they'll lose sight of the time and they'll just go on and on trying to perfect the lesson that they're learning. That's the kind of person that will excel. Whatever the field is, whether it's music or athletics or medicine or whatever it is, it requires total dedication, and that requires self-discipline. Likewise, the Christian, who merely refrains from things which are prohibited, forbidden, will probably not make his calling and election sure. If we just content ourselves with refraining from doing evil, we'll probably not make our calling and election sure. Our attitude must be as expressed in the first line of our morning resolve. What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits toward me? Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, what am I allowed to do today? What can I get away with? It says, what shall I render unto the Lord? What can I do? How can I serve? How can I better do your will? The greatest example we know of self-discipline is that of Jesus himself. In Hebrews 10:7 we read his words, then said I, lo, I come, in the volume of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God. This was Jesus' attitude, to do God's will, whatever it is. And God's will wasn't always easy for Jesus. Usually it was not. Just as God's will isn't always easy for us. In Luke 12:50, we read again Jesus' words. But I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how am I straitened till it be accomplished? And that word straitened doesn't refer to a straight line. That's not the thought. The word straitened means pressed in, restricted, hard pressed, under pressure. He's saying, I have this baptism to be baptized with, and how difficult it is for me until it's accomplished. This is not an easy way. it's going to be a difficult way for me. This describes Jesus' earthly life. It was difficult for him. It required great discipline right from the start of his ministry. Remember, after his baptism, he immediately went into the wilderness for 40 days, fasting and studying the word of the Lord, determining his will. This was discipline itself. This required self-discipline on his part. And then Satan appeared, tempting him. And we read these temptations of Jesus. We're all very familiar with them, and we think, well, these contain wonderful lessons for us. Which indeed they do contain wonderful lessons for us. But did you ever stop and think these were real temptations to Jesus? These are not just stories written for our instruction. These were also real temptations for him. When Satan suggested you turn the stones into bread, do you think Jesus wasn't hungry? He had been fasting for 40 days. Do you think he wouldn't have liked to have turned the stones into bread? Wouldn't that have been much more easy than to wait and trust until the angels would come and minister to him? Do you think Jesus wouldn't have liked to have taken an easier way to fulfill his mission on earth as Satan suggested? Bow down and follow me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world. It was a temptation. And it was a real temptation. But Jesus disciplined himself. He realized this wasn't the Father's will, and therefore I'm not going to do it. Finally, all through his ministry, he ministered to, we shouldn't say finally, first, all through his ministry, he ministered to those in need. He healed the sick, he preached to them, he healed those mentally sick as well as physically sick. The multitudes came to him for assistance, and even when he was tired and wanted to get away and rest a while, he still had compassion on the multitudes and ministered to them. This was real self-discipline, that he's willing to do this. And now, finally, he comes to the end of his earthly ministry, and his life is taken from him. But was it? Was Jesus' life taken from him? We think it was not. In John 10, verses 17 and 18, therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life, that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me, but I lay it down myself. Jesus didn't have to submit to being nailed to the cross. He didn't have to submit to being scourged and having a crown of thorns placed on his head and being spat upon and ridiculed. He didn't have to take all that. He could have resisted successfully. But he disciplined himself. He realized, this is the Father's will for me. This is what I must do, and this is what I'm going to do. He laid his life down himself. We can hardly comprehend the discipline of our Lord Jesus in his earthly ministry. We have other noble examples of self-discipline in the Bible. The Apostle Paul is a noble example. In many cases, one is found in Acts 21:13. There, remember, Paul was advised not to go to Jerusalem because persecution and imprisonment would await him there. And what's Paul's response in Acts 21:13? He says, what mean ye to weep and to break mine heart? For I am ready not to be bound only, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. Yes, he was ready to discipline himself. It would have been so much easier for Paul to say, well, you're telling me I shouldn't go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested there and put in prison. Maybe I better go over somewhere else and preach the gospel somewhere else. I can do more good there and avoid this persecution and imprisonment in Jerusalem. That would have been much easier for Paul, wouldn't it? But he realized it was the Father's will for him to go to Jerusalem. So he was ready to go there regardless of what the consequences might be. In the Old Testament, we have numerous noble examples of self-discipline. The three Hebrews were willing to be cast into the furnace of fire rather than bow down to the image which Nebuchadnezzar had erected, not knowing that God was going to deliver them. Oh, it would have been easy had they known God was going to deliver them, but they said by their own words, "We don't know if God's going to deliver us or not, but whether he does or whether he doesn't, we're not going to bow down." This was real self-discipline. Daniel was willing to be seen praying in public, knowing what the consequences were going to be, that anyone caught praying in public was going to be cast into a den of lions. And Daniel didn't know that God was going to shut up the lions' mouths. He hadn't been promised that, but he knew it was the right thing to do to pray. And so he was willing to be seen praying, even though that would be the consequence. David, when Saul was pursuing him, trying to kill him, on one occasion refused to harm Saul when he might have killed Saul. But he refused to touch the Lord's anointed. David exercised self-discipline on that occasion. And then there's the case of Abraham. Can we imagine, can we comprehend the self-discipline that Abraham displayed in being willing to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, not knowing that God was at the last minute going to withhold his hand and send a ram to be killed in his place? The Apostle Paul says that he received his son back in the resurrection, figuratively speaking, because as far as Abraham knew, his son was as good as dead, because God had told him to sacrifice his son, and Abraham was willing to do it at that point. And then we have some tragic examples of lack of self-discipline in the Bible. The same David who showed all that self-discipline in dealing with Saul showed such a tragic lack of self-discipline along moral lines in the incident with Bathsheba and her husband, wherein he not only committed adultery, but he committed murder in arranging for her husband's death. We have a tragic lack of self-discipline in the case of Ananias and Sapphira, who, pretending to sell their possession and give all to the Lord's cause, held some back for themselves and then lied about it, saying that they had given all. All these examples are worthy of our consideration. Yet most of these are in connection with major events in the lives of those involved. Most of us, most of the time, we don't have those kind of experiences. I don't think any of us have been in any danger of being cast into a furnace of fire or into a lion's den, or we haven't been asked to offer our children as sacrifices or anything like that. Most of us haven't had those major decisions, major crises in our lives. But we do have little everyday experiences which the Lord is noting how we're exercising self-discipline. And do I have to discipline my son here along this line, or will he do it for himself? What are some of the areas where we need self-discipline in connection with some of our more frequent experiences? Well, for most of us, our lives, to a large extent, are centered around our home ecclesia. Our meetings, our associations with the brethren in our ecclesia. And here's an opportunity to exercise self-discipline. In the sixth volume, Brother Russell writes a whole chapter on the order and discipline of the new creation. We recommend very heartily a periodic review and study of this chapter. It's very good, very, very good, valuable, sound advice. One aspect of self-discipline in the ecclesia is that of punctuality. We should endeavor to arrive on time at the meetings. And I think most of us do. Most of us try to be punctual. Sometimes we're unavoidably late, and this is excusable if there's a good legitimate reason. But I know of one or two individuals, perhaps you do too, who you can almost count on it, they're going to be late. They're nearly always late. These have a real problem. These need to exercise self-discipline. We have observed at conventions sometimes, the chairman standing up in front of the group of brethren and almost pleading with them to come to order when it's time to start the meeting. And they, with almost total disregard of the pianist playing the hymn and the chairman up front trying to get the meeting started. We haven't noticed that problem so much here, and we're glad to see that the brethren have been pretty prompt in coming to order. And we think that's to your credit. This shows an example of some self-discipline. It's much easier when you hear the chairman ready to start the meeting and you're in an interesting conversation with someone to will think, well, this is only going to take a few more minutes, I can finish it. What we must do, should do, is that when we realize it's time to start the meeting, cut the conversation off, say, let's finish the discussion after the meeting and promptly take our seats. But this requires real self-discipline to do this. Elders have the responsibility of self-discipline to see that the meetings are started on time as well as ended on a reasonable time. Sometimes ending a study meeting on time is harder than starting it on time, especially if it's a good meeting and you're involved in an interesting discussion. It's time to end the meeting, and how do you get it stopped? The brethren don't want to stop. Everybody has something they want to add to it, and it's difficult. But here's a case where we can all exercise self-discipline and try to realize that it's time to end the meeting and help the elder to bring it to a close if he's trying to bring it to a close. This is more important in a large group than in a small group, although even in a small group, the principle of punctuality should be more or less observed. Another aspect of discipline in the ecclesia is that of reverence. In Matthew 18:20, we have the Lord's words again, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them." We all believe this is true. The Lord is present here with us, just as much as if we could see him literally with our eyes. We all believe this. But are we always conscious of this? Are we always aware that this is true? When this meeting is over, we're going to have dinner together. I don't know. I imagine the arrangements will be similar to what they were at lunchtime. We'll go upstairs and have our dinner. How will you conduct yourself at that time? Suppose you saw Jesus himself. We know this isn't going to happen. We're not suggesting that it might. But just supposing you saw Jesus with your natural eyes, literally, sitting at the table with you, eating. Would you be speaking any differently? Would you be conducting yourself any differently as you will, as it is, when you don't see him? Would it make any difference? It shouldn't make any difference. If we believe this promise that where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in your midst, well, then we should believe, well, he's here. He's here observing what we're saying and what we're doing. So it shouldn't make any difference whether we see him or not. Some are more naturally inclined toward reverence than others. But those not so much inclined toward reverence must discipline themselves to that end. And then there are business meetings. This is also part of our associations in the ecclesia. Most of us don't really like business meetings, and I don't either. I'll be very frank about it. I wish we didn't have to have business meetings, but we do have to have business meetings. There are things that need to be decided, and it's our responsibility to have a part in deciding them. Decisions have to be made. The elders have no right to make the decisions unless the ecclesia has delegated that authority to them. And for the most part, we would generally feel it's a wise course for the ecclesia not to delegate too much authority to the elders, but to retain that authority for themselves and participate in the decision-making process. And when it comes to voting, making a decision by vote, here's another area where we must exercise self-discipline. Are we merely voting according to our personal preference, or are we voting according to the way we believe the Lord would prefer it, the Lord would like to have it done? Are we voting according to the Lord's will? Now, there, once in a while, there's something that we believe the Lord is just as pleased to have it one way or another, and here you might have a right to express your personal preference. But in any matter where you think the Lord would rather have it one way than the other, then you have no right to express your preference. Then you must, it's your consecrated duty to express what you think would be the Lord's will, even though your own personal preference would be different from that. The same is true regarding class elections. We just had a discourse on qualifications for elders, and this enters into class elections. And again, most of us don't really like class elections, and I don't particularly care for them either. I'm always glad when that matter is taken care of for another year, and we can go back and do more direct service to the Lord. But class elections are important, and they're necessary. And sometimes, when it comes to class elections, our own personal feelings get in the way. They get involved. In voting for elders or any officers of a class, are we conscious of the qualifications, as the discourse before this pointed out? Or are we voting because we like somebody or we don't like somebody? Somebody is nominated for an office, whether it's elder or deacon or secretary or treasurer or whatever, and brother so-and-so is nominated. I like him. I think I'll vote for him. Is that a good reason? No, that's not a good reason just because you happen to like the brother. Or you might feel, well, I don't like that brother. I don't like his personality. Well, is that a good reason? Well, that's not a good reason either. We have to decide how we're going to vote on, well, now, do I think the Lord would be pleased, based on what I know of the qualifications for that office, do I think the Lord would be pleased to have that brother serve in that capacity? And if you think that that would please the Lord, then you must vote for that brother. Whether you like his personality or not, if you think it would serve the Lord's purpose and the Lord would be pleased to have it that way. If you think for some reason the Lord would not be pleased with it, then it doesn't matter how much you like that person or how good a friend he is, you must not vote for him if you don't think the Lord would be pleased to have it that way. That's the only way our elections and our business matters are going to really mean anything. That's the only way they're going to be expressions of the Lord's will. Otherwise, they're going to be merely expressions of our own personal human preferences, which is not the way our matters should be decided. But this requires real self-discipline. Here's a close personal friend whom you've had associations with and pleasant fellowship with over a period of years, nominated for some office, but for some reason you don't think he's qualified. You don't think the Lord is pleased to have him serve in that office. You're going to vote against him. That takes real self-discipline. You'd much rather vote for him, but you can't vote for him because you don't think it's the Lord's will. But that requires real self-discipline. So here's one area where we can exercise self-discipline. And then our daily and regular associations with one another. As we mingle with one another, and especially as we get to know one another, sometimes we have misunderstandings. Sometimes there are hard feelings. And what do we do about it? Well, Jesus told us what to do about it. You're all familiar with it in Matthew 18, 15 to 17. There is an exact procedure which Jesus outlines to follow, what to do about it. Well, you go to the person involved and you explain the problem and see if you can reach an understanding. See if you can get the matter resolved. Is that what we do, though? How often do we do that? A brother offends you. He says something which you don't like, which you find offensive. Do you go to that brother, or do you go tell somebody else whom you have a great deal of confidence in and say, well, what do you think about this, brother? And get his opinion. And you know already that he's going to take your side, but you much rather go talk to him about it than that brother who offended you. He's the last one I want to go talk to. I don't even have anything to do with him. But that's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, go to the brother alone and see if you can resolve the matter. But this takes real self-discipline, because this is the last thing the flesh wants to do. Go to that individual brother and talk to him about it. We'd rather talk to anybody else but him about the matter. Another area where we can exercise self-discipline. Another area where self-discipline is required is that of evil speaking. The Apostle James has a great deal to say about evil speaking. James 1:26. These scriptures are almost self-explanatory, so all we're going to do is just read them and they'll explain themselves. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. That's a strong statement. Bridleth his tongue. If you don't do it, your religion is vain. James 3, 8 and 9. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. James 3, 2. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. We think these scriptures are more or less self-explanatory. We're not going to deal any more with it, as our time is just about up. Our chairman is here, and we have quite a bit more we could say on the subject. Another area of self-discipline is that of our relations with those in the world around us. And like children, we tend to copy what we see and hear. And unfortunately, a great deal of what we see and hear around us isn't good. I think I've had the experience of traveling to another part of the country, for instance, through the South, and after I was in the South for a few days, I start to speak with a Southern accent, unconsciously, because I'm unconsciously copying what I'm hearing around me. And this is what we tend to do. We tend to copy that which we see and hear around us, and a lot of it isn't good. And we have to sift that out and make sure we're not copying the things which aren't good and only copying the things which are good. And this requires self-discipline. We need self-discipline involved with regard to our personal study. Some of us need to severely discipline ourselves to make ourselves study, because we don't by nature like to study. We're not studious by nature. And others are studious by nature, and they have to discipline themselves so that they're not neglecting other duties and responsibility, but are just studying all the time at the expense of somebody else. So here's another area of self-discipline. We need to discipline ourselves as to what we study. Make sure it's the truth we're studying and not somebody's theory or opinion about something which we already know is wrong. We need to discipline ourselves with regard to earthly pleasures and earthly possessions so that we're using all to the glory and praise of the Lord rather than selfishly for our own interests. We need to discipline ourselves to engage in witness activities, especially if that's contrary to our natural disposition. If we tend to be shy and reserved, we need to make ourselves participate in witness activities, which we by nature would tend to hold back from doing. And whatever we do in regard to self-discipline, we need to make full use of prayer. We can't do it on our own strength. We can only succeed by using effectively prayer. And so this requires self-discipline too, to make sure that we're not trying to rely just on our own determination, our own effort, but we're seeking the Lord's help in whatever we're doing through prayer. We trust these suggestions of areas of self-discipline, as well as how the Lord disciplines us, might enable us to better deal with some of the daily routine problems and trials that confront us, and how we might better learn the lesson from them and be better able to serve and please the Lord. May God help us to do that. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Brother Geisinger very much for his thoughts on discipline. They were very timely, very encouraging, very appreciated, and very helpful.